Hello, cyclocross friends, and welcome to episode 52 of Crosshairs Radio. On today's show, we talk to Rebecca Farringer of the Amy D Foundation team, or I guess she's an Amy D Foundation rider. She is the team. Great conversation with Rebecca. I really enjoyed this one. I think you all will too, and we're going to get into it just as soon as I tell you about who our sponsors are for this week. First up, a little local flavor. There is a cyclocross race that is one of the last here in the central mid-Atlantic DC area. It's put on by the shop Bike Kinetic. They call it the Bike Kinetics, basically Bike Kinetic with an X on the end, or as I like to say, Bike Kineticics. Anyway, it's an awesome race. They're an awesome team. It's Sunday, December 11th. They used to have this race in Occoquan, which they are going to again in the future. They've moved it this year because that park is going under renovation. So they are out in Haymarket, and they have a pirate ship. That's the main thing that you need to know in the middle of the course. Actually, I'll be out there announcing the race, and I'll be doing it from atop a pirate ship. So that's very important. There's going to be a starboard part of the course, a port part of the course. There's going to be beer. There's going to be a plank, I believe in it. They have these things called happy humps that you have to go over. They give cool preams out, lots of prizes. It's just a really great way to end your cyclocross season, or if you're going to nationals, get in one really fun race before you head on to nationals. Anyway, tons of giveaway preams, free beer. That's what it says here, free beer. They have cash donations that go to Moor, which is our local trail building, mountain bike trail building organization. So always good to give to them. There's burns, there's off cambers, there's drop-ins. It just looks like a really sweet course, and I think all of you should head out there to take part in it. What else can I tell you? Equal payout for men and for women. I believe it's also the final race in the Sportif Cup series. So if you have any points in that, you want to come out there, try to up your standing in the series. You know, if you're in Tidewater area, if you're in Richmond, if you're in North Carolina, if you're up north in Maryland, in Pennsylvania, this is a fun way to end up your season. Come on down and party with the Bike Kinetic folks. On top of that, on Saturday, December 10th, the day before, from 1 to 3, they are going to have a preview of the course. So you can go out there and ride the course for a couple hours, help them burn in all the good lines. Other than that, you know, no pre-rides. It's private property, which is also awesome because they can sort of do what they want to do. So Bike Kinetic, go to bikereg.com/bikekinetics. BIKENETICX. That's BIKENETICX. We'll see you out there. It's brought to you by the Bike Kinetics Full Service Bike Shop. Again, that is Sunday, December 11th. All right. Also sponsoring today's show is the Chainstay. This is an apropos sponsor for this episode because in our chat, Rebecca and I talk about the Chainstay because it is basically what got her through her trip to Europe and to Belgium earlier this year. Staying with Greg, staying in the Chainstay house is, and having that expertise, that local knowledge of not only, you know, where to get food and where to ride, but also how to get to the race and actually getting a ride to the race and finding registration and doing all these things that she would have not had no idea how to do if these folks weren't there. It made it all possible because of the Chainstay. Basically, the Chainstay is a cycling guest house. It's located in the heart of the Flemish Ardennes. It's 2 kilometers away from Oudenaarde, which is, you know, if you've ever seen the Tour of Flanders, that's where all of those cobble climbs are. Went to Belgium, I think, two, three years ago, and we basically were in Ghent, and we would ride our bikes down to Oudenaarde just so we could ride on these cobble climbs. It is beautiful. So if you're just a cycling tourist and you want a central place to stay to get that, really that Flanders experience, the Chainstay is the place to do it. If you're a professional and you want that full service experience, they're able to do that for you as well. They can pick you up from the airport. They can take care of your bikes. They can actually work with you at races as well. It really runs the gamut from what you want from the chain stay. They have a deal right now. They have a couple spots left. If you wanted to go to Master CX Worlds, they have fully supported experiences for racers from the U.S. or anywhere else that want to go for to Mall for the Masters Cyclocross World Championships. Get in touch with them. They'll take care of everything for you. You can go to thechainstay.com. All of that information is there. They also just opened up bookings for the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix day trips for 2017. So again, a great central location for you to be. They know what cyclists want. They're going to get you fully set up at any level that you want. Greg's an awesome guy, really down to earth and easy to work with. So go to thechainstay.com, and next time you are in Belgium, or even now if you're planning that trip to go be a cycle tourist, which is just, if you got to do it. If you love bikes, if you love bike racing, you have to at some point go to Belgium and get the full experience. No better place to do it than the Chainstay. Last but not least, I do want to remind you about our life insurance sponsor. We're still running that, Health IQ. I want you all to go to healthiq.com/healthiq.com, that slanty thing, CX Hairs. Fill out a questionnaire, learn more about life insurance. That's going to help us, it's going to help them, and it's going to help you. So do that. Final note before we talk to Rebecca is that we started out with her on a cell phone and that had a lot of noise in there, so we moved over to a computer, so you'll hear the Monty Python intermission music come in at about 9-10 minutes, probably more because this introduction is going a little long, so probably about 15 minutes now. You'll hear that intermission music. That's just because we're changing devices, and then we'll pick right back up where we left off. You're going to enjoy this one. I'll chat with you again when it's over. Okay, so first off, Rebecca or Becca?
Oh, God, that's going to be dealer's choice because, frankly, I go by both.
You go by both. No preference.
I do.
Okay.
Yeah.
Whenever I talk to just people individually, I always like to sort of get the backstory here. But before we get into all that, how are you feeling? I know you've been sick like the last couple of weeks.
I'm feeling better. I am moderately asthmatic. So every time I'm sick, I have a 2-week log of like bronchitis, coughing, weird sporadic phlegm. So, I'm feeling better. I did a little bit of training today and it was the first time where I saw watts back to where they should be.
Yeah.
So that was good.
So I do want to like touch on that because there have been stories about your wattage, and I think that it's something that maybe is sort of behind some of your success. It seems like you're a pretty powerful rider.
I've been told.
But I do want, here's my question for you, just to, off of the sickness part, is that it seemed, or actually somebody else mentioned this after, I think, Cincinnati, looking at the people who went to Valkenburg, who all came back and maybe didn't have the same kind of results that they wanted after getting back from Europe. And do you think that doing all of that travel, A, was what got you sick, and B, may have resulted in not the kind of results you wanted once you came back to the Pan Am Championship?
I definitely think that travel and being away had a lot to do with it. My Europe block was a lot like that first World Cup block in the US, where it was a big travel, a lot of important races back to back, and then, you know, just being exhausted. So throw that again in the middle of the season, and I anticipated I might get sick. I'm still trying to find the person to blame for my illness.
Patient zero out there.
Well, I got back home on Monday, and Tuesday I was immediately back to the bank at 8 a.m. and I work with money. And I don't know if you know this, but money is like the dirtiest thing in the entire world. And every customer that comes in is like, oh, collect my money. So usually very liberal with the Purell, but I don't think there's any one person I can blame.
Yeah. So when you see those pictures of people who take like dollar hand ups and then don't know what to do with them and put them in their mouths, is just that having that inside knowledge, does that make you even more like cringe?
It makes me cringe. I, even in the bank, people like put money in their mouth and then take it out and give it to me. And I'm just like, what makes you think I want to essentially make out with you right now? I don't. So it's bad. Yeah. It's bad. I picked my European block to be early on in the week or early on in the season so that I could figure out when I came back, what will I be sick? Will I be jet lagged? Will I need more training? Having never been before. So did that early. It's like I could figure out the effects, because if I did it over the Christmas block, if I came back and felt the way I did, my nationals would just be wrecked, shattered.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So that was all just a calculated move to go early. That's an interesting way of playing, because you in past seasons you hadn't done that, so you really didn't know how you were going to react, and it was almost like a test then.
Yeah, yeah. So I talked. I work with Coach Kyle. And with Finish Fast Cycling, and you know, he really tried to plan out the season smartly even before it started, and then work as, you know, I meet certain goals or exceed certain goals, try to work. The thing that we're happy with is where we put the European block. And then I was enticed with going more, but I was like, I don't know, I'm sick, I'm just gonna trail.
Yeah. All right. You're cutting out a little. Is there anywhere else? Do you think it's like somewhere? All right.
All right.
Recording. No idea what we were talking about. No, it was about.
We were talking about how I'm a poor, sick little dog.
No, it was about this calculated scheduling. Oh, yeah. To test out how you were going to respond to European travel early in the year to, you know, so you could kick ass later in the year.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That was such a good spin on that.
But now that we've sort of gotten to sort of where we are presently, so talk to me about how you got into cycling.
Oh, it's such a boring story.
No, we like boring stories. Make it interesting. It'll be good.
Well, I mean, this is the thing. I was a triathlete.
Okay. That's okay.
So I get a lot of heckling for that. I was a runner in high school, and then in college, I was not about to try to be a collegiate runner. I like donuts too much for that. So I just sort of played around, and I started swimming, and I saw a sign advertising a triathlon at the school. So I was like, oh, I'll go ahead and give that a try. So I got into triathlon, and I did that for a few years. And then when I moved to grad school at Brown University, they have a great cycling team there, and Providence has a really wonderful group of cyclists. And there was no triathlon group that I knew of. So I ended up just riding with them, and they said, hey, you should try this thing called cyclocross. I was like, oh, okay. Sounds great. Gave it a try. And I quit triathlon and started focusing on cross. So I was never, you know, a roadie proper.
Yeah.
When I was a triathlete, my riding was on a spin bike or on a TT bike on a trainer. So,
wow. So you were like never out there on the road. That. Yeah.
Yeah. So I really, I went into the cross with a really great skill set behind me.
So after learning how to dismount, did you look back on your triathlon days and think this could have really helped?
Actually, I was always really, really good at the flying dismount in the triathlon transition there. I couldn't ever get on the bike adequately, though. That was Turns out in cross, that's where a lot of people mess up, too. But
so first,
I figured it out.
So first cyclocross race, you're not a kid.
No, I was not a kid. It would have been equally as fun, maybe more fun, but I still enjoy falling down. So it was fun.
So, you know, give me an age. What first cyclocross race, how old?
22, 23, 22.
Okay. Yeah. And just starting out in the fours and working your way up. And when did you feel like you, hey, this is something I can be okay at? And what is the scene? Where are you racing?
So my first race was Providence.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
It was old Divine Providence. Yeah. And I was in the early morning Cat 4 field, borrowed bike. I was like second to last call up or something, over 130 women, I think. It was a huge, huge field. And I had my tri shorts and my borrowed Brown University cycling jersey, borrowed bike. And I finished out of like 134, I finished 31st. And so I was like, oh, this is fun. That's a good, you know.
Yeah, it's a lot of
kill
points.
A lot of people.
Yeah.
That really boosts your confidence, you know?
Yeah.
And then the next weekend, it was a local race, Mansfield Hollow in, I don't know if that's in Connecticut or Mass. All those New England states, they're all the same.
You can say I can't.
I still have friends in Ohio that ask me what it's like living in Delaware. And I'm like, oh, I've never lived in Delaware, so I don't know. It's not even in New England. Here, let me send you a map for Christmas. But yeah, so I did that and it went well for me, but I was on the start line and I yelled out to somebody like, my tires are flat. And they're like, no, that's just what you run in cyclocross. And I'm like, no, they're definitely flat. And so I pitted twice for wheels. And and then, my next race at Canton, I won the women's 3-4 field, but I crossed the line and they were like, congrats, you're done. You won. I was like, no, I didn't. There's a girl in front of me. Like, I can't be done. I have to pass her. And they were like, no, you were about to lap her.
Yeah.
Like, oh, so that was fun. And then from there, I moved up into the elite field later that day. And I've just kind of been striving to keep getting better ever since.
That's a great story. Yeah. And so when at that point does it move from, hey, this is something that's fun and I'm good at and I'm in grad school. What were you in grad school for at that time?
I was in geology. Mm-hmm. The program was geological sciences and I was working with a biogeochemist looking at nitrogen cycling. And I was doing a lot of analytic work. I was behind a computer. It wasn't what I was looking to do. The program itself was not exciting me. And I looked at sort of my trajectory of what it had been in cycling. And I talked to some people and they said, hey, you know, you could keep doing this if you wanted. And it just sort of, I don't know, took the bull by the horns and said, I'm going to try to focus on it. I finished out my master's at Brown and I said, all right, I'm ready to step back. So I sort of left the career track there and I spent a year unemployed, just preemptively focusing on cycling when I was still a, you know, Cat 4, Cat 3. I wasn't pretending to be a pro cyclist. I just happened to also be unemployed.
But at the same time, it wasn't you found the thing that you had gone into that you were spending sort of your life on, not to be something that maybe you wanted to spend the rest of your life on. So it's sort of interesting that if that hadn't been the case, maybe, you know, you would have never found cycling or taken it that much more serious.
Yeah. If I was in something that really made me want to wake up in the morning and go and do it, I'm sure I would still want to ride bikes, but I definitely would not be able to balance a career in, you know, the quote unquote professional world with professional cycling.
Yeah.
I can't right now. I'm working just a job at a bank, 20 to 30 hours a week in trying to race a full cross season. And even that is difficult. I can't imagine the women and men, but the women, especially at that pointy end of the race who, you know, they punch the clock 9 to 5 and they have a career that they're in charge of. I couldn't do it. That's too much stress mentally, physically, emotionally. Oof.
Yeah. It's, you know, it sort of goes along with my life's philosophy as well that I've sort of followed in all of this is that, you know, there's sort of two ways to go. It's either you can find a career that you are super passionate about, that you love to do every day, or you have to find a career that allows you to do what you love and are super passionate about. So it's, you know, it's it's sort of an either or. You can't have both of those. You know, you can't. There's not enough time in a day to be passionate about.
There are some people that have been lucky enough to be able to do their passion.
Yeah.
For a living wage or higher. Just very few of them happen to be cyclists, especially American cyclists.
Yeah, that's true. I'm just saying it's hard, and there's not enough hours in the day to be able to do both. I think successfully. So, it was sort of that sacrifice you had to make. But it's interesting that you did it. I mean, it's an interesting mix because, like what you were talking about before, you weren't super young getting into the sport to start with, but then pretty much quickly, just because of life circumstances, you decided this is something that obviously I have some talent in and then I can focus on. So, you know, moving up to that elite level, then sort of taking some time off and then deciding this is what I'm going to focus on. What happens then? I mean, where do we progress from there?
If you find an answer to that question, will you?
Well, what, I mean, I guess going back, you know, where,
well, it's tricky because I would love for cycling to be my number one job. In theory, my number one money producer, but that doesn't really seem to be a realistic view. I think, you know, you need to find a team that's willing to put money behind you, either enough to last year round or find a road deal and a cross deal. So far, I haven't really been able to do either, but I'm going to, you know, keep putting my resumes out there and keep working at it. I feel like, you know, one of these days there's going to be a sponsor that's going to put enough money into the sport to see the people at the top end be able to put their passion into it, to advertise their brands, to give it their all. They've got to be able to see the worth at some point. I'm just hoping for that magical day.
Yeah, no, I hope so as well. Talk about just the rise then to get, I hate saying talk about, let's discuss, just getting into like the Amy D Foundation and getting to that point, you know, how you progress to be able to get into that program?
I don't know. It was sort of by chance, actually. I saw that I saw Erica racing for the Amy D Foundation, and I was opened up to the idea of what the foundation was by watching her race the year before I got in. And I learned it was a wonderful program, giving her great opportunities. She was seeming to thrive that year for sure. And when I was looking for a program to move into and, you know, hoping to thrive myself on an expedited track due to my advancing age, I applied when the application came up, and I was like, well, I'm probably not going to get it. There are so many qualified people out looking for teams. And then, you know, I wasn't hearing back on the application and I was getting really antsy. And then I did some Googling and I called Don Kellogg. Like, I called his cell phone just on a whim. And I was like, hey, are you guys going to like fill the Amy D spot anytime soon? Because I knew Don Kellogg, head of the Raleigh Clement team, then fostering the Amy D rider. And he was like, we're working on that. Who's this?
That's awesome.
I was like, I'm sorry for imposing. I sent you an application. Perhaps you're familiar with my name. If not, put that on top of the sack. So I sort of forced my way into the into the spot. And I've forced my way into the Raleigh Clement tent ever since. Much to the dismay of the mechanics and everybody else. You don't live here anymore. So it was, you know, again, it was an application process, and I saw the application open, and it was simple as that. Build it and they will come. They got a ton of really great applicants, and I was lucky to get selected.
So
at least that first year.
Yeah. And then after that first year, unfortunately, it didn't seem like anybody, there was any other teams that, or any offers out there that allowed you to move on, and they you're basically with the same program again this year, but I think if you look at your racing and your results and just how you're, you know, doing as a racer, it seems like you've definitely made a lot of progress from the beginning of joining AMED until now.
I've made the progress, not just as a racer, but an athlete, if that makes any sense. Working with Dan Dombrowski with the AMED Foundation, he, through his own learning curve, has been able to teach me so much about sponsorship, both accepting a sponsor and then working to be a good advocate for that sponsor. You know, we work with the sponsors themselves and figuring out what they want, but also, you know, he's taught me how to balance various levels of sponsorship and how to treat them. We have discussions about just ways to embrace them, you know, showcase them in a positive way and an organic way. In addition, both he in the Raleigh Clement team last year and now the Stans No Tubes team this year, it's been a really great process of developing and learning how to balance a season, how to choose your races, how to allocate your assets. You know, this race might be more prestigious, but this one is cheaper. And, you know, well, the budget is worth this one, but maybe not this one. And it has been just a huge experience, again, from a physical athlete standpoint, and then the business part of being an athlete, of running yourself as a human.
Yeah. And I think that even, you know, that's a hugely important part about it. But then on top of it, you're starting to see these results that have to give you more confidence. I mean, you talk about Providence being the first race that you were ever in, and then you come back this year, you know, no longer in Providence, still same race, KMC Cross Festival, on the podium both days. That's a huge jump.
Yeah, that was pretty incredible. That was a really big weekend for me. First C1 podium with the, you know, I guess 3-year crossiversary, as I'm calling it, and yeah, that was huge. And I would hope that everybody else sort of, you know, sees these results. And this is sort of embarrassing for me. The past 2 weekends, I was upset with my results, and I have to talk with people. On a bad weekend, I'm still getting top 10s. Like, the fact that I consider those bad results, I feel, you know, kind of like a jerk for considering it a bad result. But
I think it's awesome also, because I think it's that you've just sort of recalibrated what you expect out of yourself. And that's, you know, mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's that. There's nothing wrong with that. That just shows that progress that you've seen. I mean, especially 3 years in, it's pretty amazing.
And you know, I think all athletes, especially once you get into that elite level, we all have this sort of type A, almost, you know, too big of a personality of like, no, that's not good enough. I can be better. I deserve this. And sometimes it's hard to use that word of I deserve this, but it's something that you have to tell yourself as an athlete. Like, I work hard. I deserve to let myself be confident and put myself in those, you know, higher positions. And don't talk yourself out of a podium spot just because you're like, oh no, this girl that's coming up behind me, she's pretty fast, she deserves that.
Yeah.
No, you do if you work hard. So it's sometimes hard to try to balance being humble and confident.
Right. But it's also getting over, which I think that I've talked to people before about, just in similar situations, it's that imposter syndrome and just putting that out of your head that no, yeah, you do deserve to be up there.
Yeah. I like that, imposter syndrome. Yeah. It's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's just thinking that you don't belong where you actually do. And I think that a lot of people at your level that are able to break through that, and it seems like that's the way that you think about these things, are the ones who are successful. But yeah, so the Providence, which seemed, I'm assuming, was a career highlight, not Providence anymore, KMC career highlight.
Not Providence.
Yeah. And then, so, did you go, you went to Europe last year, right? Or no?
No, I did not.
No. So this was the first time. So yeah. Straight out of that sort of high from that weekend at KMC, and then you're over in Belgian racing in Zonhoven. I gotta know, first off, just even previewing that course, what your thoughts are, because we're looking at it on TV. You got the kiln and all of these just, you know, classic looks that we see with all that sand and those huge drops. And what's going through your head when you're over there course?
Oh, my goodness. I didn't. So the past 2 years, I've watched these cross races and I sort of know what to expect, but there are some sandy ones. And I kept saying Zonhoven instead of Valkenburg. And I'm like, what race is this? And I had no idea. I don't know. I sort of went into it blind. And three or four people came up to me and they were like, wait, your first race in Belgium is going to be Zonhoven? Really? that's the one you decided to do? Just jump right into the lion's den. And I, again, not really knowing what to expect, the week before, thank God, my boyfriend Nick, he's like, all right, we're going to go do some sandy descents. You'd think I would have at this point looked up what Zonhoven was.
That's amazing.
But I was just like, okay. So we went to a little sand quarry or whatever it's called. And I tumbled down the sand a few times and, you know, got over the fear of plunging down into it. And once you learn it's fine to crash on the sand, it's pretty easy to go down it fast. And it's better to go down it fast than slow. So I had that buckled down. And then I look at a picture of Zonhoven and I'm like, oh crap. And then I get there and I think it's best that I only had time to do two pre-laps, because otherwise I probably would have overthought it and kept crashing and it would have gone terribly. But I had just enough to get confident without overthinking it. I mean, the course, it was fun. Pre-riding it was fun. Racing it was difficult. But I mean, the sandy plunges, they're long, but not, honestly, they didn't seem as steep as they did on looking at it on TV.
Okay.
They didn't.
Yeah.
But no, the entrance was scarier, because a lot of the entrances that I have practiced, you just come straight into it. But this, you're turning a 90-degree turn into it.
Right.
The first plunge. The first plunge, not too bad.
Because you're sort of up on that wooded ridge and then you sort of turn right and dump down into it.
Yeah. So the first one is the left and then you run up and then you have the right one. But with the wooded ledge, there are tree roots that form that ledge and you have to drop down over the tree root, which means you're turning on a sandy tree root into a chewed out rut.
Yeah. Like, was that, and what's the, you know, when you're coming in there, I mean, I just can imagine that the crowd at that point is just enormous and just kind of nuts.
Oh, in pre-ride, I had a couple attempts of going the right-hander over the tree route. Tried a couple different lines, like, oh, in traffic, I bet this is going to be better. And then I would just continue to, you know, tumble down and leave my bike at the top. And the spectators, they're trying to, maybe they're mocking me or trying to help me. I can't tell because they're, you know, speaking in Dutch. I'm like, I don't know what you're saying, but they seem to be very helpful.
Pointing out the better lines in the sand. Yeah.
So you're saying to stay on the bike. All right. Thank you.
Noted.
And so what's funny is everyone asked, like, oh, what was it like racing in that crowd? Honestly, I don't remember the crowd at all.
Sure.
I just remember the other people. That first lap was carnage. Just everybody laying down and you're like, oh, wait, do I ride or run? And I rode down the first plunge, ran up, and then on the second one, it's like everybody just laid down at the top. And then I saw Sophie DeBoer get off and run down. So I was like, if Sophie DeBoer is running down this hill, I guess I will too.
Well, that's good. That's a good person to follow as far as technique goes.
Yeah. That was good.
Yeah, no, that's great. So again, you know, it's something that you're able to be up there with those riders who are in the top of the world. That had to be a bit of a confidence boost, especially in that first race, really not knowing what you're getting yourself into.
Yeah, well, it was interesting going into that race because I didn't have my familiar, comfortable faces, you know? Usually you look over and you're like, oh, you know, I'm next to so-and-so and that kit is the kit I'm supposed to be with, or I shouldn't be by you. I need to hurry up and like go faster. But there it was just like, I have no idea who you are. Should I be in front of you, behind you?
Yeah.
Am I racing?
Yeah, that's, like, that's really interesting. And it's something that I think a lot of, maybe even a lesson there for amateur racers who you're always kind of stuck with your own little group. You know, you're in your mm-hmm. local series and you're always seeing this woman and that woman or this guy and this guy, and we're always racing together. And maybe it's like, if you put that out of your head and kind of get out of that zone, you can, you know, break out of that group. So maybe it was not having that expectation of knowing who you were supposed to be with, maybe gave you the advantage to try to find a different group.
Yeah. I mean, I was honestly that on Zonhoven, I was in it for survival.
Yeah.
And it was racing in Europe. The biggest difference in the fellow racers, I found that in the US after the first turn or two, we don't sit up, but it's the charge slows down.
Mm-hmm.
In there, the charge is there. And then nobody is complacent with their place. You know, they don't look around and say, oh, well, I'm with so-and-so, so I guess this is where we're going to finish, so let's just stop fighting now. That sounds terrible, but I feel, at least that's how I raced, and that's how it feels like others race around me. There were girls that were like pushing one another to get around the turn and fighting tooth and nail to get in front of you. And they came in like 30 places back. Once the finish line comes
sure.
around,
yeah.
But that first lap, there are no rules. It is, if I can get to the front of this bike race right now, I'm going to, even if I know I'm not going to finish there.
Yeah.
That was eye-opening. It was definitely eye-opening. And I don't know why it's different in the US, or maybe it's not. It was my perception different, but
no,
yeah.
I don't think my favorite story is from, about that Joe Dombrowski, who races on the road for mm-hmm. Cannondale, went over for cross camp years ago, and his story is always, he's like, yeah, you know, first cross race I was kicked in the head, shoved and elbowed, and that was just in the starting grid.
Yeah. Sounds about right.
Yeah. So it's definitely, I think that, and it's always, I always like hearing stories like that, because we have, again, you know, not to pick on amateur racers in the US, but again, there is this thought that, you know, there's somehow this zone of protection around anybody that you're not allowed to get into when you're racing, that definitely doesn't exist in Europe, in that there's no personal space, and people are going to be inside of you, and you sort of got to defend yourself.
Yeah, but at some point when I'm racing, I look and I'm like, it's not worth hitting their derailleur and, you know, setting them back a couple hundred bucks. And it's not worth shoving this girl into the fence so that she breaks her arm. Like, God, we all have to, you know, get up and do something tomorrow morning.
Right.
I don't know if that thought process is different there, or if it's just the confidence, or if I'm just a huge wimp, I'm a softie. I don't know.
So, on that European trip, you know, after Zonhoven, you ended up doing what, like four races in a week?
Yeah, I did. I was supposed to do five, but I didn't do Poldercross on Saturday because it was advised to me that it would be too much, because I arrived on Friday afternoon. Hmm.
Yeah, that probably was a good call. But you moved on,
yeah.
Kermis Cross, and then sixth place there, and then the Niels Albert Cyclocross, you got on the podium.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah, so, you know, well, first off, with the points you were getting from a nice start to the season, you know, you must have been staged up there pretty well, first, second row.
I was, I think, second row at yeah. Zonhoven, and it felt weird. I'm sure that, you know, the fellow racers like heard me called up and they were like, who's this girl? What's she doing up there? And I sort of like slunked up to the start line, like, oh, don't judge me, I just have American points. And I have to mention Ardui, Kermis Cross Ardui.
Yeah.
It was the race that I did on, I guess it was Thursday. And that was the only muddy race that I did over there, but damn, was it muddy.
Yeah. So, I mean, when Belgians come here, they talk about our mud and they're like, it's just completely, they can't even process it. Like somehow the mud is completely different. Is that what you felt coming from the US and then seeing Belgian mud?
The mud at Ardui was kind of similar to what Jingle Cross was
okay.
last year, but still different. It really was like a cow field that was a muddled mess. So when it was mud, it was up to your mid shin and you were just hoping your shoes stayed on as you were running through it. And then, but the course was flooding. And so there was water at one point up to your knees and you can ride through it, but then there's a punchy hill. So you run through that and then you mount and then you ride down the next into the puddle just as deep. And there's spectators telling you, they're like, Lynx, Lynx. I'm like, I don't know what that is. But Christine Vardaros was like, I was pre-riding with her and she was like, that means left. So I guess we should stay left here. So we go left. And then some guy takes the line on the right on pre-ride and he goes, oh, ass over tea kettle because he hits a big hole that you can't see because it's knee deep water. And then these guys just start throwing sandbags into the course to fill the hole that we can't see because it's just muddy water.
That's amazing. Oh my goodness. Yeah. It's just good. A whole different world.
It was crazy. Our Dewey was a blast. It was fun. When it's muddy like that, for me, I'm not going to say I'm a mutter or anything, but it makes racing fun because you're just sliding around and like having a big mud fight with your friends. So it kind of takes some pressure off.
Yeah. But I think that it probably also, you know, we're talking about you being a powerful rider before. So it's got to be something that plays to your strength as well, just being able to fight through that mud when you're riding.
I heard somebody describing another racer and they said, oh, that's so-and-so. She's a farmer. And I'm like, what do you, so like she does farming? Yeah. Oh no, she's a farm. Like she just goes and plows through the field.
Perfect.
And that was their way of saying that she was a powerful rider.
Yeah. Well, you know, Veldridgen, isn't that like field riding? So, you know, makes sense.
It was pretty funny, but I enjoyed that. But yeah, so Ardu, I just had to mention that because it was so much fun.
So you can be like the farmer, like FAHRMER. It's going to be your new nickname.
Oh, no, but the go far is the most clever pun I've ever come up with.
Okay, well, I don't want to mess with that.
That.
Okay.
Speaking
of that, a lot of, you know, what we're talking about now, you go into as well on your site. It's gofar.com, right?
Oh, it is. It is.
Okay. GOFAHR.com. Y'all should go check that out because that was a great, you have some nice articles on there and the one just about this recent trip to Europe was really cool. Just sort of working it through. And what I enjoyed reading about it and what I really love seeing is that you went into it just accepting everything that was going to happen and prepared for it and just sort of going with the flow, which is, I think, what, at least from the people that I talk to, is how you are successful in Europe and especially Belgium, where things may not necessarily ever go as planned or no one's going to tell you anything and you just got to figure things out on your own.
Yeah. If I didn't have people there who knew what was going on, I wouldn't know where registration. Well, first of all, I wouldn't know where the races were, obviously. Maps? What are those? Just drive me. But like registration, not being like, you can't just park your car and that's where you're stationed. And then you walk to registration. And then like, that wasn't how it was at every race. Like registration was in a different building. And then you had to park in a special area because you're, you know, an elite damas, not a dude,
right,
or a junior, yeah, or like it, just those little bits. And having the people that knew the system was definitely good. Oh, by the way, even registering for races, I had to email like 30 different people. So there's a website. It seems to not work.
Oh no, websites in Belgium just don't play well together.
No, they don't. And at first I was like, is this a translation issue? Because I trust Google with a lot of things. And if it can't help me here, I don't know what to do. I'm at a loss.
Yeah. No, it's like, yeah, they're like back in the 90s, I think, as far as web design goes. And yeah. Oh, well. But
that can be my new job. I know nothing of web design, but I think I can do better than what they have.
I think you can too. So, I mean, yeah, you should be a developer and then you'll be good to go. You'll revolutionize cyclocross just through giving it a workable internet.
Yes, at least over in Belgium. It seems to be pretty good here.
Yeah, exactly. So the mud race, and then moving on to the Niels's race.
Niels's race.
And So how does that play out? How do you find yourself in that lead group?
I didn't find myself in any groups. I'll admit it was a small field. It was definitely the Saturday before a World Cup. But I don't know. I pre-rode the course, and this is what I said as soon as I finished a lap. This is just like Vegas, but a little bit steeper. It's in a bit of a bowl, and you just wind up and down and up and down and up and down. And then there's some sand, and you're like, can I ride the sand? I don't know. I'm just going to run it. And that's pretty much the course, up and down and up and down and up and down. And then there was a weird bridge that had an art installation that was like periodic, sporadically placed basketball hoops. But they weren't basketball hoops, but I could only see the trunks of them. So you turn onto this bridge, and if you turn too tight, you just hit a metal pole.
Oh, were like hitting part of the installation?
You were inside.
Oh,
of
you were
it.
In
yeah,
it. It was, okay.
maybe it was an installation piece that they put in for the race just to make the riders dance around them. I don't know. But I turned, like, how is this okay? You have to count each and every one of those poles as a man-made obstacle. So I think they exceeded the 8 or however many you're allowed to use.
Well, you know, rules. Rules are especially the day before a World Cup. They're not going to. Who's looking?
Nobody's checking. Nobody's checking. But so it's funny. I could vaguely hear the announcer at most parts of the race. And every time I came through the line, he started speaking English, and that was pretty cool because then I could hear how many laps I had to go. Because 2 and 3, I kept thinking were the same number, so that was awkward for me. I forget if 3 sounds like 2, so every time something said 3, I was like, oh, 2, and then sadly mistaking. But so I guess somebody, Nick, who my boyfriend, who had ended up showing up for both Niels Albert and Valkenburg, made the trip over for spectating and photographering and cheering in general. He was like, oh man, it was crazy because every time, you know, the announcer talks about you, he's like, oh, and there's Rebecca in 3rd for now. So he's saying like, she's in 3rd for
fail.
Now.
That's
then,
amazing.
As with, you know, like 2 to go, he's more like enthusiastic, like, here she is in 3rd. And the spectators are starting to be like, oh, you're in 3rd. You're really doing it. And so, yeah, the tone of the race, just where I was in my own little lonesome area, it was changing throughout to be more and more optimistic.
It's kind of funny, too, because you're in that nice spot where, you know, you're not Dutch, so the Belgian fans aren't against you necessarily. You're sort of this, you're sort of this oddity out there with being the American. You know, if you're in the men's race, it's like all the dudes that show up from, you know, I guess like Canada now or Australia and have beards. Okay, that's an oddity. We'll just cheer for them. So it's actually kind of nice that you don't have like any of that negativity, and everybody seems to be on your side.
Yeah, I hope there's no negativity. I think it also helped that I was wearing the Amy D kit, and I don't know how many do associate.
I was wondering about that too. If they put that together, that's you know like Telenet Fidea, Amy Dombrowski, and that's if that connection is made.
Some of the Telenet fans and writers did come up to me and be like, "Oh, I was friends with Amy, and oh, you know, that's great to hear. It's really, you know, nice to meet you, and glad, you know, her name is being remembered." And I did. I don't know if you saw it. I had an interview over there. A guy came up and asked me some questions about the foundation and what it meant to be wearing the foundation name over there, and a little bit. So that was exciting.
Yeah, no, that was awesome.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. So I do think wearing the Amy D kit, it was really important to me that I'd be able to wear that kit over there and just get, you know, get her name back over there. And then also just get the foundation some sort of FaceTime over there. Like, hey, you know, this spirit still exists. So let's support these American women because we rock. It's cyclocross.
Exactly. So here's an interesting thing coming up after that race on the next the next day on the Sunday, you have the World Cup. And you would think for most people who are making their first trip to Europe that it's also going to be their first World Cup experience. But at this point, you're practically a veteran. I mean, this is going to be your third World Cup of the year. You've done all of them. So that at least had to be some sort of familiarity with that setup and just that race. And, you know, there maybe a little more so you knew who you were going to be around and the people you're racing with.
Honestly, not even. Okay. Because
because it's a feel of maybe people who didn't show up for the other races.
Yeah, I actually recognized more girls from the races I'd done prior in the week than I did from racing in the World Cup races. Because at least in the World Cups, you know, we had our American field.
That's
and then
true.
We had the top end of the Euro riders. And frankly, in Valkenburg, the top end of the Euro riders put a little bit more distance between us than they did when they were in the U.S. So I didn't really get to see them, unfortunately.
That course always described as like a mountain biker's course, you know, very wooded, lots of climbs, lots of more single tracky stuff. How did you find Valkenburg?
I finished Valkenburg and I said, I can't wait to come back and conquer this course next year.
Great.
It had a perfect mix of elements that some suited me really well. It was climby. And it was unforgiving, which normally would favor me, but I was pretty exhausted at that point. Honestly, I didn't even know when I put the trip on my schedule, if I would be ranked high enough to be granted access into the World Cup. Like, I didn't know if I'd be a top 50 rider. I didn't know if America would fill it. And so I was just like, if I can go, that's a bonus trip. So I didn't go into Valkenburg knowing I was fresh or having planned for it or peaked for it or anything. So I was like, meh, it's icing on the cake. But the course itself, they did change it. So I don't know what it's been in years past, other than from what I've seen on the television. But I know that they changed the course this year. And I mean, the off cambers were tricky because you go into them ripping fast. And, you know, sometimes there's a rut, sometimes there's not. And there's some sections with, you know, some roots and rocks, which maybe that's a feature of some sort in Europe, but in the US it's just par for the course, right?
Yeah, exactly.
But I can't, next year I'm going back. I don't care if it's still the weekend before Continental Championships. Like, now I've seen the course and now I have to give it my best so I can see what I can do on it.
So that's an interesting point then. So a race like Pan Am Champs, you wouldn't consider to be like an A race. I mean, I know some people who put that as the race that they want to peak for. It doesn't sound like that's necessarily what you're looking at.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the trip that I planned was planned for the timing in the schedule in that it was far from nationals, mm-hmm. but also that week was great because it was dense with races. You know, I didn't want to make my first trip over there for a weekend. You know, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to get my money's worth for the ticket. And then I noticed, like, crap, it's the week before Continental Championships. Like, what the heck? And then I look at the breakdown and I'm like, Continental Championships only matters if you win.
Right.
And so when I was planning this trip, I said, there is no chance in hell I can win that race. And then my season was going how it was. And I was like, all right, there's like a 3% chance with the right probability of mechanicals that I could maybe win. But I still ranked, you know, I'm on AMD Foundation, a development team. I need to focus my year on development as a whole, not on, I'm going to try to win one race this year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a very important race that many others of equal or greater capability are vying to win as well.
So that being said, then, you know, talking about, well, a couple questions here. First of all, just with the development, how do you think, you know, going to Europe, seeing these more technical courses that as a rider you've developed, do you think that like technical skills and that kind of stuff that you're starting to improve? And would you say that's something that when that starts to kick in more, that you know, you're going to be a more complete rider?
I'm definitely a more complete rider this season than I was last. I tried to spend a lot of time this summer on the mountain bike and more time scaring myself, even on the road bike, just simply descending faster and taking turns faster, riding in groups tighter. I tried to really push my comfort limit. Next year, I think the bounds are going to be pushed even further. The European experience did a lot of things for me. I feel like I want to race more aggressively now, but also I got to see that there are other riders that have, I mean, in the US too, but even over there, there's still some trepidation to taking some of these descents and, you know, they still mess up too. So it's that, you know, sometimes seeing the weakness in others lets you find your strength in yourself.
Sure. That's awesome. Yeah.
Cause all of a sudden, you know, being hesitant is no longer a weakness. You're like, okay, I'm just playing it safe. If everybody else is scared, I can do this. Bombing. Then you just go down the hill.
No, that's great. So having this really good beginning of the season and then having this European trip, now being sick, probably, you know, again, top tens, but not the results that maybe now that you have this elevated expectations you're looking for, where does it go from here? I mean, is a podium for nationals? Is that what we're looking at? Even more than that? And are you heading back for Europe for more World Cups? That's a lot of questions thrown in there. So just pick out anything.
It's all pretty much all the same answer. I'm going to seek world domination. One of my main goals this season is qualifying for Worlds, which is a very tricky thing to do as an American woman because we have so many qualified women, like so many. Every single week, I'm like, oh man, she's really stepping on the toes of that next qualification spot. I don't know. You know, so many riders. And then, world qualification, that's a big goal. Assuming I qualify for Worlds, heck yes, I'm going to go over and do more of those World Cups and races around that time. But up until then, Nationals is my goal. So I don't think I'm going back to Europe before Nationals. Because I would love to podium. I think if I had a really, really stellar ride, and hopefully others were not as on their game, I think it's definitely possible. If I was willing to put in the biggest fight that I've been able to find in me. but if I went to Europe, I don't think I would go in fresh enough to be able to do it.
Right.
But a podium at Nationals would be a huge, huge, huge result. I'm aiming for top five and hope, sort of expecting top five and then hoping for a podium. I guess that's a good way to phrase it.
Yeah. No, I think those seem like reasonable expectations out there.
You know, you say that and then you think like, oh, you know, I just have all of these other people to deal with.
Sure, you do. But, you know. And now you're going to go in there without fear and, you know, you're going to be just kicking ass and it'll be all right.
I should get a sponsor from that no fear company.
That's exactly. Yes. That's the kind of, it would be good too if you had that clientele out there cheering for you as well. It would be good.
Exactly. That would be need to get wondrous the thing the
MMA,
for our coverage.
The MMA crowd out there would be good. That'd be good.
Yes.
That'd be awesome. No, but I think that's good. I think those are all good goals. And then do you think that, is it anywhere in the plans? Would you want to stay in Europe like post Worlds and do that whole, you know, extra run after that? And I guess sort of the question along with that, are you able to do that? I mean, work-wise, is that something that you have the flexibility to do?
I'm out of vacation days, yeah. But after...
Hey, but this will be 2017, so...
I know. So I could use those. And my favorite thing that Coach Kyle says is, please don't let your bank teller career get in the way of your bicycle pedaling. Which, you know, I'm definitely willing to part with my part-time bill payer if it means putting myself out there with hopes of a contract coming out of it for my bicycle pedaling.
Yeah.
And yeah, I'm, but also, I think that, you know, hopefully they're willing to be flexible. And if I just say, hey, man, I just need a couple more days because I'm chasing this dream. You don't want to dream shatter. You don't want to be a dream shatterer, do you, corporate?
Right.
Do you?
Of course not. And is this so as far as finding that sponsor, you know, that support for next season, is it an ongoing process?
I am apparently months behind the curve on all things. Apparently you're supposed to think about road during like the previous year's road season, and you're supposed to think about cross. I don't know when you're supposed to think about cross. For Europe, you're supposed to think about cross, you know, well before January. For Americans, you're supposed to think about cross in about September.
Well,
September,
you know.
Just ironic because most people seem to be scrambling for teams. Like, right. Come on, my season's tomorrow. Am I on a team?
So it's
always ongoing.
Yeah. Are you looking beyond the U.S.? So I know, for instance, Marlux, you know, just picked up two women for their Belgian team. Not saying that they, you know, that would be on the table, but would it be, are you looking beyond the U.S. for sponsors? Would you move to a European team if that opportunity arose?
I would like to reach out to Marlux and say, I have a lot of experience cleaning bright blue kits. So
you do.
I'm
exactly.
Not saying this is not a terrible sexist, like, I'm a woman, let me do your laundry, but I could share some tips and I could be an asset to the team. I could save us a lot of money. I've after my 1 week there, which is a vast amount of experience. I'm pretty sure I'm an aficionado on all things Belgian and cyclocross.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
I'm willing to spend a season there. I couldn't move there full time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, my life is here. Basically a very cute boy is here.
there's a lot of video work in Europe. I'm sure it could work out.
Yeah. Yeah, I would go there. I could do it for, you know, a couple months, do some early season races here, go there and race for the duration, come back for nationals, go back for worlds, whatever. I don't know. I would do it. If this is a thing that I'm willing to quit grad school for, it's got to be a thing I'm willing to go all in on.
Sure.
And if that's the way to do it, then that's the way to do it.
Yeah. So the state of cyclocross or cycling. Well, actually, first, let me ask you this, because you're talking about the road season. Is that something that you have any interest in? Do you think that is something that would be beneficial to your cyclocross career, like racing on the road at all?
I think racing on the road would be beneficial to my trying to call myself a professional cyclist. the biggest problem there is finding a road team that is willing to accept the fact that you have a focus that may not be them, you know?
Mm-hmm.
'Cause, you know, worlds and in the cross season, they overlap. So is that going to cause an issue for a team? Who knows? I don't know.
Yeah.
I would definitely, if somebody was like, here's a road contract, I would pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm somewhat actively seeking them. Otherwise, you know, I guess I would guest ride. I like riding on the road only because I just like pedaling my freaking legs until my eyes are bleeding.
I think that's a good quality.
Like mountain bikes, if you do that, you crash and you hit a tree. But right. I just like going on the road and feeling so much pain that I just want to keel over and die. But I just want to get across the finish line first before I do that. Like, that's just what I want to do.
I can't believe that road teams wouldn't be like knocking down your door after hearing that. That seems to be perfect.
I don't have to be the winner, but yeah. I want to be the one that suffers the most.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I just really like it.
No, I don't think you should overthink that. I think that you don't have to know why. I think that's probably a good thing.
I think I have to go ride the rollers right now. I gotta go.
Okay. But actually,
chew on my stem for a while.
Well, then let's just start to wind down. But I do want to touch on, because you are an outspoken advocate for not only women's cycling, but just sort of getting a fair shake. You know, I mean, there have been things in the past from course preview time to equal pay to whatever else it is. that you should be commended for speaking out on is how do you think the state, especially in the US, of women's cycling is right now, especially in cyclocross, and what's sort of your list of things that still really need to be worked on?
Oh, that's a huge question. You just mentioned the word winding down.
I know.
You pose. I would have to say, you know, the U.S. does a wonderful thing for women in sport across all disciplines of cycling, across everything. On a world level, the U.S., they think ladies are all right. You know, I think we get a pretty good end of the deal here, but it's obviously still not equal. And in cyclocross, I've heard a lot of arguments about the equal pay thing of like, well, you know, the races aren't as long, or
that has to be the worst argument ever. I mean, if you want to make, and I don't agree with it, but if you want to make a, well, we don't bring in enough money because the fields are smaller, which I don't think is true anymore. Okay, I can see that economically, but a shorter race is just like the dumbest argument ever.
I doubt it's promoters that are making that argument, but I've definitely seen men say like, you want equal pay, do equal work. Trust me, I am more than willing to pedal my bike as hard as I can for 60 minutes,
right?
70 minutes. Go ahead. Give me another 3 laps, guys. Well, see what I do.
And you can look at the top level pros, the race that we saw just today, and the 37-minute race that Sonic Hunt won was much more exciting than the hour-long race that I can't even remember who won after it today. So it's not like you're giving the spectator more for their bang by having a longer race necessarily.
Yeah, but either way, so
yeah, okay. Sorry.
That might be silly. Some registration numbers, they flip-flop. Sometimes there are more elite women than men, it seems.
Yeah.
But there are so many more fields for men. And in local races, I'll admit, a lot of times the women don't show up. But there simply aren't as many women with racing license. So if you're going to have a huge race weekend in this part of the country on this day, then how can you expect all of the women to also go to all the local races? I don't know. That... I can only speak at the elite level right now. I think, you know, you got to sort of start with the equality on the local level, but that's a whole different fish to fry, especially in the eyes of a promoter when you're running a UCI race versus a local race. So race length, not an issue. The number of entrants, maybe not an issue. But going to what you said, an interesting race to watch, especially if you're talking about American women. For the number of U.S. racers in the top 50 in the world right now, I don't even know how many there are. But we have to be, you know, one of the most densely talented nations of cyclocross racers in the world. And I don't know how sponsors don't see that and they're not willing to throw money at it for either, you know, showing us racing live or... just wanting to give us sponsorships because we are like, we're the best. I'm just going to say it. I think American women are the best cyclocross racers right now. And I think cyclocross racing in the women's side, like you just said, it's more interesting than watching the men. It's great to watch the men because I swear sometimes they go uphill faster than I go downhill. And I don't know how, but the watching the racing itself, you know how it's going to pan out. And at some point, you're just watching some guys futilely chase a couple other guys that are just going really fast, impressively so.
Yeah.
But the women are always battling back and forth. And any weekend, there's 3 to 5 women that could win.
Yeah.
And you don't know who.
Yeah.
It's incredible. It's so incredible. And we get the short end of the stick on coverage. In the U.S. races, the live stream never seems to work for the women.
Yeah, I don't know why. Well, the live stream's just—that's a whole another issue. Yeah. But you're right. You're absolutely right. And it shouldn't be. If you need a test, you know, do an amateur race or do whatever is before the elite women. Don't flip the switch for the first time. You know, when the women are at staging.
Yeah, and you know, in Europe. sometimes they're not aired at all, right, or it's a highlight reel, or we're racing in the background while you can see the you see the commentators up in the box talking. And you're like, oh, look at the ants in the background. The women are going. I'm sure that a lot of people would be more interested to watch. Well, I guess here's the question. Why are people going to cross races? Are they going to hang out? Are they going to race themselves? Or are they going to watch racing? Or are they going to support a friend who's racing? Or are they going to support a racer that they are a fan of? Whether you're in the US or Europe, those are going to be completely different answers. But if you're in it for racing, I feel like everybody should be going out to watch the women race.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that.
Yeah, it's great. But we also get the short end of the stick sometimes in course preview and course building.
Yeah, that was the interesting one that I think that you brought up that I just like to touch on a little. Yeah.
What race? It was a late season race in Texas last year, and the UCI preview window just abutted the women's race for staging. And I went up and I said, hey, why is the 30-minute window for UCI pre-ride always immediately before the women's race? Because typically we can't use that. If you're pre-riding and your bike breaks, you are screwed because you don't have time to fix it before staging. You don't have time to, like, if you use that as a warm-up, are you going to go to the line muddy or do you change? And it's this whole, you know, line of issues. And the UCI official told me, well, if we put it earlier, the men have to be here all day.
Oh, that's a horrible reason.
And I was like, do you know that we have to get here not just an hour earlier? We have to get here hours earlier because instead of having one 30-minute window, we have to use two or three 10-minute windows an hour apart in order to do our pre-ride. And then most of us have to stay until after the men anyways because that's where our team has men racing or our pit person has a guy working – working the pits for a guy. You're like, we're here anyways. Why does it matter if the men have to come an hour earlier? Like, what?
Yeah. And even the reason that I guess would make more sense, but that I also really don't agree with, is that they'll say that, well, we're changing the course for the UCI races and we can't do that before, if there's an amateur race afterwards, which is sort of, ridiculous too, because you can always open it up for the pre-ride and then put it back to the amateur race but that's one I've heard as well. If there's like pro only sections that, those can't, they don't want to open and close those if there's still amateur races to be run.
Yeah. Or if you leave it open, then it puts the amateurs or even the elites at risk for course crossings. I understand the struggle, but it's so frustrating that it's women who are the continuous short end of the stick. If anything, I'm going to turn this and say that it is it's a compliment to us because we don't even need to pre-ride. We are so skilled.
But I would be an advocate of, if you have a double weekend, flip-flopping the men's and women's.
I like that.
I mean, maybe,
being tricky. It's tricky from a planning standpoint because you sort of know your routine of like, well, at this time I eat and at this. And if you change the times, that's a dumb reason. And that's why I like to not have routines. But I love that idea. I think there are a couple races that do run the men first, which is good for them because they also get the short end of the stick when it comes to venue food afterwards.
Yeah.
Venue food always packs up during the men's race and leaves. So they finish and they're like, I had to look at those brick oven pizzas all day. Now I can't even have one.
Yes. My race has been guilty of that in the past and we tried to change it this year, but yeah,
I understand. It's tricky. Everybody's got to, they've got to earn their keeps and make their days worthwhile. And sometimes that's getting home to get their own dinner on the table, but
all right.
Racers.
So maybe that's something we can start floating here is the flip-flopping the men and women's elite for double weekends. All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I like that.
That's something. We solved it.
Yeah. we did with one simple stroke, but I would at least like the men to go first on Saturdays then, because sometimes they're still building the course while we get called to staging, which then, at one race, they're still like staking out the course, and Katie Compton goes, well, we're all in the same boat, so it's okay. I don't care that you guys are in the same boat as me. I want to be equally respected here.
Right.
I want the respect of having the freaking course done before
right.
I go to staging.
Right.
I've been training literally since the summer for this race. Like, what? We work really hard to be ready. I got to staging on time. Why is the course not done?
That is something that you would expect to happen. Yeah, that there's actually a course to race on if you're going to stage a race. But all right.
Oh, well.
Ah, well. Hey, so anything else you think we need to chat about?
I'm all fired up and like,
I know. Well, now you got to get on that. Now you got to get on the trainer. You're going to just crush it on those rollers now.
Oh, man. I might see those power numbers jump up a little bit more. Just got some anger watts.
Awesome. Well, Rebecca or Becca or both. Thanks so much for taking the time and chatting. This has been good. I've enjoyed it. And so when are you racing again? When's the next?
I am doing Supercross, which is. I don't know the dates of that.
Yeah.
You'd think I would, but I don't.
Coming up.
I'm taking a weekend off and then Supercross. And then I am very, very tempted to go to Belgium to race the weekend of Thanksgiving, but I'm not going to. But there are no races in the U.S. So now I'm going to eat all this turkey and do what? Run a 5K? Come on, people.
you could drive down to Taneytown, Maryland. It's right on the Pennsylvania border, and just show up for the Maryland, DC, and Delaware state championship. And seeing that people in Ohio think you live in Delaware, you could just go win the Delaware state championship.
That would be a legitimate win. That would be a legitimate championship.
Yeah.
You don't understand. People think I'm from here.
Yeah.
You want me to be your state champion.
So there you go. So that's, Sunday of Thanksgiving. Taneytown.
Perfect. I've got my plans.
All right. Good to go. Awesome. Well, again, thank you so much. And best of luck the rest of the season. We'll be cheering you on.
I hope so.
All right, there you have it. Episode 52 in the books. That was a great conversation with Rebecca Feiringer. Follow along with everything she's got going on Twitter and Instagram at GoFar. That's GoFAHR. Also at her website, GoFar.com. You can get in touch with me at feedback@cxhairs.com. Also follow along at cxhairs on Instagram and on Twitter. Doing a lot on Instagram still, so would love you to go ahead and follow that account. What else can I tell you? Bike Kinetics, December 11th. Come to Virginia. Come race your bike. Come hang out with me. Go to bikereg.com. Slanty thing. Bike Kinetics with an X on the end. B-I-K-E-N. B-I-K-E-N-I-T-E-C-X. Yeah. HealthIQ.com, slanty thing, CX errors. Somebody on Twitter told me it's not a backslash, and now I'm all just, I don't know what to say. If somebody knows what I'm supposed to say when I give out URLs, go to feedback@cxairs.com and let me know. And then I'll let you know next time on episode 53, which will be next week. See you then.